You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of August 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Today I will tell you with lots of prayers and lots of thinking. Today, I tell you as West Virginians, I can't help you anymore being a Democrat governor.
West Virginia Governor Jim Justice picks a curious moment to rejoin the Republican Party. As special counsel Robert Mueller impanels a grand jury, are we going to see more traffic going the other way? My guests James Chambers, Gaia Lutz and Marcus Hippie will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Harvard University's first majority non-white freshman class, the holidaying preferences of those that lead us, and a sneak preview of Monocle's new summer weekly newspaper. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's James Chambers, Gaia Lutz, and Marcus Hippie. Welcome all to the program. And we will start in the United States, where it does now appear to be the case that Robert Mueller, no relation, the special counsel attempting to untangle President Trump's ties to the Kremlin, has impaneled a grand jury. This might, you might think, be the moment for those who set sail aboard the SS Trump to begin elbowing their way to the front of the lifeboat queue. But not West Virginia's Governor Jim Justice, who's names suggest a phoned-in late on a Friday afternoon pitch for a new superhero who has picked this moment to defect from the Democrats to the Republicans. James, first of all, some perspective here. Of course, Jim Justice only has been a Democrat for about 15 minutes. He became a Democrat because he thought it would be convenient while running for governor in 2015. That being the case, is this that big a deal?
You know, we talk about fake news with Trump. And in this case, I think it's perhaps not news, because a lot of the headlines have been saying, you know, surprise, surprise, this guy is now a Republican. Why wasn't he before? You know, if you kind of look through his CV, it's remarkably similar to Trump's. He's inherited his wealth from his father. You know, he has interests in golf and hospitality. You know, he's a coal exec as well. So, you know, he's got a lot to talk about with Trump. And as you said, he was a Republican until 2015. And now he's switched back from being a Democrat. And with Trump, no one knows where he stands. You know, he's a Republican president now in name. But, you know, who knows? He used to be a Democrat, too.
He was at one point, I think I'm right in saying, a donor to Hillary Clinton's presidential campaigns. Gaia, Mr. Justice, and I haven't got tired of the name Jim Justice. It does feel like he should have a kind of stable of spandexed comrades around him. I don't know what else they would be called. It's got to be alliterative. Sort of Tim Truth or something. Jim Justice, is he then acting, do we think, out of pure self-interest? He was elected with 49% of the vote, I note, whereas Donald Trump won 69% in West Virginia, where, of course, the legislature is also run by the Republican Party. He's just doing what's good for Jim Justice, is he not?
Yes, I think that's right. But I think also, you know, as James was saying, sort of endorsing Trump doesn't come as a surprise. I don't think it's just he's moving now because that's good. Perhaps that was always, let's say, in the back of his mind. He is a co-executive and he never endorsed Hillary Clinton, even, you know, when he was a Democrat. He didn't go as far as endorsing Hillary Clinton. So it is self-interest, but I also think it's perhaps a self-interest that was always there, and perhaps he just changed to Democrat.
What I'm wondering over there is whether Jim Justice is actually going to be facing these actions in the future. Is he losing credibility when he seems to be so flaky, going back and forth between two parties?
Well, Jim Justice, as James has... Have you thought of changing your last name to Justice, James?
Well, I have a law degree as well, so it'd be quite legitimate.
It would be perfect. But Marcus, the big story is, of course, the news that Robert Mueller does appear to have empaneled a grand jury. Does this feel like a major step forward in attempting to figure out what the deal has been with Trump and Russia?
Well, once again, we are in this situation that if we talked about anyone else, it would be a major development. But at the same time, we're talking about Donald Trump here now, and it seems that he seems to be going from one scandal to another. There's bad news for him on almost daily basis, and nevertheless, here he is, still heading the White House and the country.
But as you said at the start, Andrew, it is amazing that, you know, it seems to be getting worse and worse. The news seems to be piling up, but you have all these, you know, Republicans and new converts actually coming out and in support of him. I was surprised to see Paul Ryan, you know, making a visit to the wall and talking about how they're going to build it recently. Now you think he was never pro-Trump at the start, and yet he seems to be doubling down on his support these days.
Guy, it's a question I feel like I've been asking our guests for literally 2 years now, and you may be due some sort of prize, as possibly the 10,000 or 20,000. Guest I've put this question to, but further on that, why are Republicans, like proper mainstream Republicans, that is, the Republican grandees, the Paul Ryans of this world and others, who presumably have ambitions of a life and career in politics beyond this, why will they not give him up?
You're going to have to keep asking that question. I'm not sure, Andrew. I'm really not sure. I think Trump represents something for... I'm actually really not sure. I think there's an element that perhaps there are many Republicans that actually feel that he is right and honest in the situation. I find that hard to believe, but you have to ask them.
I think what Trump has shown is that, you know, you can just change your track if you want. You don't. It used to be a bad thing to be a flip-flopper. Nowadays, it seems like you can, you know, turn on a sixpence. So, you know, Paul Ryan's doing what's best for Paul Ryan right now. You know, when Trump leaves, when, you know, that could be next week, it could be in, you know, 7 years' time, he can adjust, he can move on, and he can say all of that was a mistake and, you know, go in a different direction.
But I don't know. I think even calling Trump a flip-flopper is to impute rather more intellectual coherence than he deserves. He doesn't actually hold positions of any sort, and he just does keep, as recently as the rally in West Virginia at which Jim Justice, whose name I still haven't got tired of, went over the wall, he does just keep doing this thing, Marcus, of saying things which aren't true and are obviously demonstrably not true. One quote from his speech in West Virginia, he said, "There were no Russians in our campaign." His senior advisor, Boris Epstein, and you would think there's a bit of a clue in the name, was born in Moscow. Why does he keep doing this?
Because it seems that there is no one who actually would make him responsible for those lies. Media companies are trying to point out that he's lying all the time. But it doesn't seem to matter, because so many people, American voters who support Donald Trump, they want to hear those lies. They want to hear what they believe in. And I think Trump knows that really well. Trump knows exactly that he can get away with all those lies.
And I think there's an element of, you know, you do it so much more than that it becomes more true somehow. I mean, if he just said one lie and then went, oh, that was a mistake. But I think now he's in too deep and now he's just going to lie until the end, and somehow it gives him, in his head, more credibility and the party more credibility.
And he's developing this, I guess, powerful platform by going on these rallies, and he's going to have to continue doing it. You know, it's his own mini media company, and you know, he's... I'm not sure the people who go there want to hear the lies. They just want to hear from him, and whatever he says, they believe.
Are we getting... And I'll put this to all of you. I'll ask you first, Marcus. Are we getting anywhere near, if not the actual end of this nonsense, at least an idea of what the end of it might look like?
Andrew, I think we have asked this question already many, many, many months ago. And
many,
people were
many
saying
times.
That this can't keep on going for a lot further, a lot longer, and it's still going on. I don't know. To be honest, I don't know what to believe in anymore. I think that we may get a surprise announcement sooner than we even expect, or this may actually keep on going for years.
James, you raised the appalling prospect of this going on for another 7 years. Well, it would be, yeah, near a 7.5, actually. It is amazing to think it's only been 6 months. But the thought that has been floated in the last 24 hours especially if a lot of writs, subpoenas, summonses, etc. are issued by the grand jury, could we see the sudden resignation followed by the equally swift pardon from President Mike Pence?
We all get the impression that, you know, Trump likes to win and he wanted to win the election, but he's not particularly enjoying being president. I don't necessarily see him giving up easily. He might prefer it. He might prefer to be back in Trump Tower sleeping on his own silk sheets. But I think he's quite stubborn. And if people come at him, he's going to just kind of, you know, fight even harder. So, you know, I don't see him rolling over that easy. I think he's going to draw this one out.
Gaia?
Well, it can go on forever, for sure. It can go for another 7 years, as James said. But I do think the grand jury does mark sort of a milestone in the investigation. You know, I've been reading a lot about what a grand jury is and just the way it is, you know, it functions and how, you know, they can call witnesses on hours and of testimony, and they're not allowed to be with their lawyers. And this is all to prevent, to get people to trip up on their answers. So they have to consult lawyers outside the room. I think, you know, given how careless, you know, Trump Jr. has been of his emails, I think someone might trip up in one of these testimonies pretty soon. I'm not sure how serious that will be, but I'm, you know, it does look like it's a real fishing expedition, a grand jury, and someone might be soon enough sort of saying something that's wrong.
Okay, well, let's look now at another story from the United States, and one which seems unlikely on balance to be unreservedly welcomed by those who were mooing Donald Trump and Jim Justice in West Virginia yesterday. Harvard University reports that for the first time in its long August and Ivy-covered history, the majority of its incoming freshman class is non-white. This is good news, of course, in terms of what it says about expanding access to educational opportunity, but will it be good news for the affirmative action programs upon which Trump's administration seems determined to crack down? This is, of course, where we are now going to treat our listeners to 5 or 6 minutes of white people discussing the rightness and wrongnesses of racial quotas. I will come right out and say I don't know what I think about these things. I do think that the expansion of access to educational opportunity is a self-evident good, and this does seem to have accomplished that in this instance. Marcus?
I believe it's been scientifically proven that your socioeconomic background is a determining factor when it comes to education. It's important. If your parents are well educated, it's probable that you're going to go to great universities as well. If your parents are not, if they are from a poorer background, it seems it's quite likely that you won't go to universities.
And in America, of course, socioeconomic stratifications and racial stratifications are often remarkably similar.
Exactly. So that's why I think we need some kind of systems to support those coming from less privileged backgrounds. But then again, this is extremely controversial. Universities often actually don't want to talk about these things because they know that there's always a potential for some kind of a lawsuit if they make them too official and if they make them too clear. So it's quite hard to get them to talk about these things because, well, we're talking about sensitive issues.
Well, it can get you into a weird area quite quickly because, Gaia, even if you are acting with the most impeccable of motivations, you still are talking about making selections on the basis of race.
It's positive discrimination.
Well,
right,
yes, but the key word, as some would have it, is discrimination. So I guess the question you can argue is, or the question to put is positive discrimination a contradiction in terms?
I think it is. I think it's, as Marcus said, a really, really, really sort of controversial topic. I think what everyone can agree is that a good education depends on sort of a plurality of views and sort of a diverse group. No one wants to go to university where everyone agrees with each other and comes from the same background.
Actually, I think quite a lot of people want to go to universities which is part of the problem.
But the university, that would go against what a university is for. That's not how you learn. And I think if you're making the sort of positive discrimination in the name of, you know, making your university a better place so that individuals can profit more from it, I think that's something. Now, if it's just to sort of make some sort of racial makeup, I think that's not so right. I think it's more about, you know, getting people from different backgrounds, different races, all sorts of differences, so you can ensure different views in a classroom more than anything. And I think that's a positive thing for education.
And there's always then the counter argument that you want to get the best minds together from all around the world, and that's when race is actually not a determining factor at all.
You also get weirdnesses, James, such as complaints by a coalition of Asian American students that they're being discriminated against by Harvard because their marks were too high.
Yeah, this is a lot of we see a lot of this in China and Hong Kong, because there's a huge market for going to US Ivy League universities, and parents spend a lot of money and put their kids through hell to make sure that they get into those schools. You know, a lot of Asian kids are working, you know, 24/7 and doing, you know, homework and extracurricular stuff all the time. It sounds like a very miserable upbringing, but this is all to get into these colleges. And you know, we get story after story about them getting almost 100% in certain exams. And in that scenario, it seems quite unfair that they get they win on merit, but they don't kind of tick the right kind of positive discrimination boxes. So there's a lot more to this story than just the 50.8% of non-white students that got into Harvard. You know, we've got to look at the makeup of that. You know, there's African Americans, Hispanics, and Asian Americans, and Native Americans, and Native Hawaiians even. And so with the Asian contingent, it seems that has stayed static at 22% the last 2 years, which I find very surprising, given how much money and effort is being put in America amongst the Asian community and also outside of America in getting kids into those kinds of schools.
On a related note, Marcus, we should also look at a group, the Russell Group here in the UK. The sort of coalition of the top universities have made 10 Brexit demands to Theresa May in order to try and maintain Britain's status as an educational hub following Brexit. Is this on that very long list of things that people really should have thought about before the referendum, which nobody did?
Absolutely, absolutely. When you look at, what the UK is famed for, one of them absolutely is education. And I know I've got friends who work as academics and they are British and they are working in other European countries. And they are faced with a bit of suspicion now because no one knows what their status is going to be in the future. They don't know themselves either what is going to be happening after Brexit, what is going to be happening with funding, what's going to be happening with their right to work in European countries and so forth. There's a long, long, long list of things that should have been thought through before the election, before the referendum on European Union membership, things that should have been talked about but weren't. And I find it actually personally quite frustrating.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with James Chambers, Gaia Lutz and Marcus Hippie. Coming up next, a look inside Monocle's summer newspaper.
Hello. Have we been introduced properly? We should get to know each other a bit better. We're Monocle 24, the radio station brought to you from the makers of Monocle magazine, the global print title that was launched in 2007 to deliver a briefing on everything from affairs to design. Headquartered in London, Monocle has built up a network of bureaus in Tokyo, Singapore, Hong Kong, New York, and Toronto. And we also run our own stores and cafes where you can get a good coffee, a nice cake, and a copy of the magazine too. Then there's monocle.com, where you can listen to this radio station and all our archived shows, watch the films made by our film team, and visit our e-commerce store. Intrigued? I just knew we'd get along.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Gaia Lutz, James Chambers and Marcus Hippie. Now, on August 10th, which if I've done my maths is 6 days from now, a newsstand near you will be enlivened by the latest Monocle publication. This is Monocle's Summer Weekly, of which there will be 4 instalments. Before we discuss what's in the first edition, here's Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck.
We're intrigued both by the pace and delivery of news you get in a newspaper, but also just the scale of a great paper. That's appealing, obviously, for commercial partners. It's appealing for photographers that you work with. And it's also appealing for some of the journalists in this room who'd like to write a bit more and write long form. The question was, okay, what would we do with that format? And how would we look after our readers, our photographers, our writers to do something special? And again, touching on that notion of the length that you write at, the delivery of image, it feels the right time to do something that's a little bit more long form in places and also something that's a little bit more joyous or creative in the use of photography again.
Andrew Tuck there, Monocle's editor, previewing Monocle's summer newspaper, available August 10th. James, what do we know about... I mean, I know what I've written for it, and I would, of course, argue that those articles are well worth the cover charge on their own, but what else is in it?
Well, the newspaper, the new newspaper, it's been a very exciting project. I was sitting in Hong Kong with Tyler, our editor, a couple of weeks ago, and he'd brought over some of the proofs when it was still a top secret project, and he was showing me some of the mock-ups and what it's going to look like. Now I'm in London. A couple of us have been brought over to work on it, and it's starting to come to life, and we're all looking forward to the first issue coming out next week. I don't want to give it too much away. You know, a lot of it still has to be written. It's meant to be a newspaper, so we're going to be responding to the news. It's a bit more timely than the magazine, because we have that opportunity now to react and to respond to what's going on next week. So it'll be, you know, a bit like the magazine in terms of the layout. We're having the usual run through affairs, business, culture, design, you know, entertaining and fashion, but it'll be across three sections. It's on, you know, very, very good premium paper from a lovely printer in Italy. So it's you know, in the era when a lot of newspapers are racing to the bottom, you know, Monocle is holding up the standard and coming up with a premium paper. And it's going to still have our same global coverage. So, you know, we'll have some great reporting from the Middle East. We'll have a lot of stuff from Europe. We have some great defense stories. And we have the usual touches of lifestyle in there. So the best summer recipes and where to go on your holidays.
Marcus, will it be akin to the Mediterraneo and Alpino newspapers, which our longer serving readers may recall?
That is something that might actually, I think so. And I think it's amazing because I was just talking about this some months ago before I even found out about this project. And I was kind of in a very nostalgic fashion recalling those times when I was still living in Finland and reading those newspapers. And it was a very different experience just because of the format. It actually felt like there was a different take. It was refreshing stories and exactly the kind of summer reading you want to have when you are enjoying the sun on a beach in Helsinki, as in my case I did. It's not always raining there. And or alternatively, when it's the winter holidays and you're somewhere nice skiing.
I like the idea of weekly magazines as well. I think there's not enough of them.
I agree totally as well. And I think it's probably quite refreshing for many Monocle staff members as well to actually go into that kind of rhythm instead of doing a monthly magazine, actually doing something that comes out every week.
We are doing both at the same time.
Exactly.
The best of both worlds. But I think the idea is that this is, you know, the Monocle magazine is more of a keepsake. And this, even though it's a premium product, is meant to be a bit more of a throwaway thing. You buy it, you sit by the pool, you read through it, and then you leave it behind for someone else to pick up rather than with a magazine taking it and adding it to your collection.
Or recycling it responsibly, of course.
Yes, and hopefully it'll end up in some fish and chip shops.
Yeah. Do they still do that?
I don't think they're allowed. I think the print probably contaminates it. And we'll be using a lot of high-quality, expensive print. So.
Yeah, a tip that we can probably pass on to our listeners, probably don't wrap fish and chips in it, which is not obviously to detract at all from the overall quality of the product. Just use it as, you know, it was intended to be used. Guy, what are you most looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to, I think, you know, as James said, it will have similar things to the magazine, the global outreach, the sections, the different sections. But I'm just looking forward to reading affair stories that are a bit more timely. I think we do that on radio a lot, obviously. And it'll be nice to, you know, work together with the magazine team to create, you know, this halfway between sort of featurey stories and timely stories.
It's also great that I feel like we're in the same boat now. Everyone is pitching in to come up with this amazing product. And I think it's great to be in this kind of a work environment. I used to work for big companies in Finland, and everything happens so slowly. If there was a Finnish media company doing something like this, that would have been in planning for 3 years before. And then here we are in London at Monocle HQ, and we just create a newspaper.
Okay, well, one item which definitely appears in the first issue of Monocle's Summer Weekly, and I know this for a fact because I wrote it, is a look at where heads of government and heads of state go on holiday, accompanied by a few gentle, and indeed in a couple of cases not so gentle, suggestions vis-a-vis where they should. President Donald Trump, who in 2012 tweeted, "Don't take vacations, what's the point? If you're not enjoying your work, you're in the wrong job," will be spending 17 days at the New Jersey Golf Club named after himself. He also said while campaigning last year that he wouldn't have time for golf. He has now spent slightly over 20% of his presidency at golf clubs. Gaia, first of all, 17 days at a golf club.
Shoot me.
Yeah, I think I would honestly rather spend it in prison.
Yes, but as I was saying to you before the show, I think a cruise might be worse than the Gulf. I don't know. Golf club.
What about a Gulf cruise?
Oh, terrible. That's worse than prison for sure.
Yeah, I don't know. James, are we too hard on our politicians about where they go on holiday? Because it's always a thing, isn't it? Especially in this country. Britain especially doesn't like their prime minister to be seen to be enjoying him or herself too much.
I think so. I think there's a lot we give politicians too much of a hard time. One of my bugbears is pay. I think if we paid them enough, then they perhaps wouldn't get all this trouble with expenses. When it comes to holidays, you know, I don't particularly care that Trump is spending his weekends playing golf. You know,
I'm absolutely happy for Trump to be playing golf. I would rather he spent more time playing golf. I'm worried that he spent 80% of his presidency being president.
Yes, indeed. And I think, you know, given we expect our leaders to take some of the most difficult decisions, and it seems like, you know, this used to be silly season where nothing went on and politicians could disappear like the rest of Europe and just forget about their jobs. But a lot of the time you see many politicians trying to enjoy their holiday and they get called back by some incident. It seems to happen every year. You know, with our Prime Minister Theresa May, you know, she's in Italy and going to Switzerland. Now, I'm sure someone's going to criticize her for not holidaying in the UK. Mm-hmm. You know, I thought it's quite a bizarre decision on her part that she's, you know, meant to be representing this kind of post-Brexit government and she's holidaying in Europe, whereas Cameron was very pro-Europe and he always used to holiday in Cornwall. But, you know, I believe that, you know, where you holiday should not be a reflection of your politics. She likes walking. The walking's good in Switzerland, so that's why she's going.
I never got the impression that Cornwall was David Cameron's first choice. I doubt he's going to be holidaying there much anymore now that he's no longer Prime Minister. Marcus, where does a Finnish Prime Minister go on holiday?
Well, I was just going to say that the Finns have come up with a solution if anyone is annoyed by politicians travelling somewhere. We have the president's summer residence in a small town on the west coast. So basically, there's always the massive pressure for them to go there and spend a month and a half over there.
But in summer in Finland, it's still like -7 or something, isn't it?
that's a message I'm trying to get through in the world. It's not always miserable over there. The sun does shine sometimes, over the course of a week and a half in July.
So, Guy, is there then something to be said for Donald Trump's actual insouciance in this case, of him just saying, like, screw it, I'm going golfing for 17 days. The hell with you.
No, he definitely can go. I agree with James that where they go on their holidays shouldn't say anything about the rest of it. But it's just funny that he's a president who said he hates holidays. No one should take holidays. You know, if you love your job, you should be doing that full time. It's just a funny thing. And it's also, you know, something I would never do. But fine by me. Exactly as you said, spend more time golfing and maybe the country will somehow turn out better.
It pains me to say this, but in his defense, I think there was some suggestion that he's actually being booted out of the White House temporarily because they need to refit some kind of air conditioning unit or something. So everybody has to leave. And so he has an excuse, and I'm sure he will use it if pressed.
He has reportedly described the White House recently as a dump.
He has, yeah.
There really is...
And a swamp.
I think swamp is a metaphor, if you will. But nonetheless, there really is no pleasing some people at all. Marcus, would you recommend Finland as a holiday destination for other foreign leaders?
I actually would. If you want to find some peace and if you want to kind of be incognito so that no one recognises you there and you can hide in your cabin somewhere in the middle of a forest, Finland's place for that. There are some places where you have about 10 people in like a massive area of Lapland.
Would Mr. Putin be welcome at the moment?
I think he would. I think he would. And I think Theresa May may find some hiking environments there as well. Great for trekking.
Well, on that hospitable note, that is the end of today's show. Marcus Hippie, Gaia Lutz and James Chambers, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Jonathan Whitfield. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. There's more music next. 1900 Marcus is back with the menu. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 London time on Monday. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.